Baruchim Abayim, ladies. We are studying Parashat Vayeshev Yaakov. I'm sure you understand why we changed the venue for today's class, and God willing for the future classes, only because we felt it's more. You need heat, they turned it on. You want everything? Then we have your chairs now. Heat the next one. I don't want to spoil you. But Be'ezat Hashem, maybe it's more comfortable when we get everything in order, that everybody should have a seat, everybody can be comfortable. We are studying Parashat Vayeshev Yaakov. Our parasha begins with the story how Yosef HaSadiq was 17 years old. Thank you, Jack. So maybe we don't need it. Maybe we don't need it.
No, but it's not enough.
It's not good, right? It's not done.
No, I think for you, come on.
It's a bit. No, it's okay. Let's try it. Let's see. Jack, is it good? Maybe we can play with the. Where's the machine? Where's the Hadi?
The machine?
Yeah. No, maybe we can make it clearer. It's like not worse than Shabbat. Maybe it's better now? So the Torah tells us. The Torah tells us of Yosef HaSadiq at the age. That's very uncomfortable. It's bothering me. You'll hear me, I'll say loud, I'll talk loud. Yosef at the age of 17 years old. It says that he had dreams. And he dreamt how the sun and the moon and the stars were bowing down to him. And he went and he told his brothers the dreams. Now, that turns out to be a mistake, because the brothers resented Yosef. The reason why they resented him, it says, is because Yaakov Avinu favored Yosef more than all the other children. The Pasuk writes he even made him a special robe, the Ketonet Pasim, and he gave it to Yosef. And as a result, the Pasuk writes, Vayishne'u oto. The brothers resented Yosef because of that. Velo yachelu daberu leshalom. They could not speak words of peace with him. They were at odds with him. There was mahloket. And the Pasuk writes, he tells the brothers, and they say to him, after he tells them about the sun and the moon and the stars bowing down, he has a second dream. What was his second dream? He dreams of storks, that they're in the field, and Yosef's stork is in the middle, and the brothers' storks are around, and they're all bowing down to the stalk of Yosef. So when the brothers heard the second dream, already they said it's enough. First he's telling us that we're going to bow to him, the stars. And then you're telling us that we're bowing to him with the stalks. So the brothers say, what do you think? You're going to be the king over us? Imashol timshol banu. Do you think you're going to be the ruler over us? But Yosefu otseno oto, and the animosity only grew. It only got worse. Now we have a rule in the Gemara Berachot Daf Nun He. The Gemara says that when it comes to dreams, hakol holech ahar pitaron. Dreams are very sensitive in that they come true according to the interpretation. That's why the Gemara gives many stories of different people that had dreams. And if the dream was interpreted positively, a positive result happened. And if the interpreter gave a negative interpretation, a negative result happened. That's why the rabbis are always careful whenever a dream is given to them, they always explain it in a positive way. It seems that the definition decides the outcome of a dream. The brothers, unwittingly, when they heard the dream, they reacted. They said, "Oh, does he think he's going to bring a king over us? What does he think? He's going to bring a Moshel? Does he think he's going to rule over us?" Little did they know that that reaction was actually an interpretation. Because that was their interpretation of the dream. They were saying, it seems that Yosef is going to be the king over us. Although they said it sarcastically, they didn't mean to say it as an interpretation. They said, who does he think he is? Well, he thinks he's going to rule over us, we're going to bow to him. What does he think, he's the king? They didn't mean to interpret. They were just saying it as sarcasm. But in truth, since that's what came out of their mouths, everything they said came true. Yosef became the melech over them, and he also became the moshel, and he became the ruler over them. What is the difference between a melech and a moshel? Melech is a monarch, a king. But usually a king, when you use the word melech, he's accepted by the people. The word melech is used when there's consent. A moshel, on the other hand, is a dictatorship. That's what we'll call absolute rule, where the dictator rules against the will of the people. They just have to accept him out of fear, but they really don't want him. That's why, ladies, if you notice, in our prayers we have a pasuk. Ki ladonai hamelucha u'moshel bagoyim. What does this pasuk mean? When we're talking about the relationship between Jews and God, God is our king. Ki ladonai hamelucha. For us, we accept God as our sovereign ruler, willingly, happily. Adonai melech, Adonai malach, Adonai yimloch le'olam va'ed. Jews accept the kingdom of God on them. However, when it comes to the goyim, how do they look at God? U'moshel ba'goyim. They do not accept His kingdom as a melech, but as a moshel, as a sovereignty that's ruling over them against their will. They have no choice but to accept God, but it's by force. Ki ladonai hamelucha u'moshel ba'goyim. But when it comes to the attitude of the goyim, God is a moshel. And this is exactly what happened with the brothers of Yosef, to the T. Do you remember when the brothers came down to Egypt? The brothers were forced to bow to Yosef. Yosef at that time was the king of Egypt. Did the brothers accept Yosef as the king? No. In those moments, Yosef was a moshel over the brothers. They had no choice. They're in a foreign land. The dictator is in control. And therefore, the brothers came down to Egypt and they had to bow down to Yosef without accepting him. However, if you remember, after Yaakov Abinu died, the brothers now were scared that Yosef might take revenge. They were thinking that, yeah, as long as Yaakov is alive, Yosef is holding in his vengeance. But now that Yaakov Abinu is dead, maybe now's the chance that Yosef is going to settle the score. So what did they do? They came back to Yosef again, and they bowed to him. And what did they tell him? Hinenu avadim. We behold are your servants. Which means at this point, they accepted Yosef willingly. They accepted Yosef as the king. So therefore you see exactly what they foreshadowed when they reacted to the dream. Hamaloch temloch alenu. Im mashol temshol banu. It all came true. Yosef was a Moshel to them, and he was also a Melech. There was a time where his kingdom was not accepted, but it was by force. That's when they originally came down. And then later on, when Yaakov died, they accepted Yosef as a Melech. Hence, you have to be very careful. What comes out of your mouth right when you hear a dream, you're always supposed to make sure to say something that's positive. No matter what they tell you, say, oh, it means you're going to live to 120 years. It means you're going to have a lot of parnasah. It means you're going to have a lot of health. Even if you can't exactly fit it in, what the dream has to do with health, but the words that should follow a dream should always be words of blessing. Because you never know, even if unwittingly words come out, they might come true, like in the case of Yosef and the brothers. The Torah tells us that the brothers went shepherding. Vayelchu Ehav lir'ot etzon avihem b'Shechem. The brothers were doing shepherding work in the city of Shechem. Vayomer Yisrael el Yosef. So Yaakov Abinu tells his son Yosef, Halo achecha ro'im b'Shechem. Behold, your brothers are shepherding in Shechem. Lecha ve'eshlachacha alehem. Let me send you to them, and I want you to go see how they're doing. I want you to come back and give me the report. So the pasuk says, "Vayomer lo ineni." Yosef says, "I am here. I am here, ready and willing to serve you, my father." Now, Hachamim point out over here that this was a great sacrifice. What Yosef did, he knew the brothers hated him. He knew that he was putting himself in a very dangerous situation. You have to remember, now he's going to be alone in the field with the brothers. Now already he's risking himself to be alone with brothers that don't have the best feelings towards him. He could have told his father, listen, Dad, I love you. I'm willing to do anything for you, but no, this I can't do. This is too difficult. This is too big of a risk. But what is Yosef HaTzadik's reaction when his father tells him to do something? Hineni. I am here, I am ready. Yosef HaTzadik epitomizes the highest level of kibud av, of respecting his father. Not like today, that children look for every excuse in order to wiggle out of respecting their parents. For every reason, I'm too tired, I can't, it's too difficult, later, tomorrow, let my brother do it. Today children look for every excuse possible that they could run away from this important mitzvah of kibud av va'em. We must teach our children to be like Yosef HaTzadik. Here his father was asking him the most difficult of tasks, a task that puts his life in danger. And Yosef does not even hesitate. He doesn't say, I'll get back to you tomorrow. He doesn't say, let me think about it. Yosef says, Hineni, I am here, ready to serve you. As a matter of fact, Rav Chaim Palachi, in his Sefer Tochachat Chaim, he says this was a trait that all our forefathers possessed, Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. They all respected their parents. For example, Abraham Abinu was told by God, Lech Lecha. We read that parasha. God tells him, leave your father's house, leave your birthplace, leave your country, go to a land that I will show you. Abraham Avinu tells God, my father is still alive. It's not going to look good. People are going to say, look, Abraham Avinu leaves his aging father. Is that nice for a son? Yeah, but God's telling you to do it. Yeah, but still, it doesn't look nice. It's a bad precedence. It's a bad lesson to the future generations. That in the name of religion, you leave your father at home. So what does God say? God tells Abraham, I appreciate your concerns. I'll handle it for you. So if you look right before Parashat Lech Lecha, what does the Torah tell us? Terah, the father of Abraham, died. Oh, he died. Then Abraham left. Ladies, he didn't die. He was still alive. Terah didn't die till much later. So why does the Torah put the death of Terah before God tells Abraham to leave? In order that Abraham should not be looked upon, at least to the person that's reading the Torah superficially, it should not look as if he disrespected his father. But why did the Torah write it? Only because Abraham was concerned about it. To show you how sensitive the Avot were when it came to their parents. I ask you a question. Gadol Ador? Who was Terah? Terah was an Oved Avodah Zarah. Terah was an idolater. Terah was a Rasha. And still, Abraham Avinu was concerned, what are the people going to say? It's going to look like I'm not respecting him. Therefore God concealed it in a way. Yitzhak Avinu, he respected his father in probably the greatest act of obedience ever done in history. There's always a question. When Yitzhak Avinu allowed his father to sacrifice him, almost sacrifice him, not Yitzhak. You have to keep in mind, ladies, Yitzhak Avinu fulfilled the great mitzvah at that moment, the mitzvah of Kibud Av. Imagine your father comes to you one day and says, God came to me in a dream last night and said, I have to sacrifice you as a Qurban. You'd come along and say, maybe the father became senile. Maybe he's becoming sick. What kind of thing is this? Father telling a son, I have to sacrifice you as a Qurban in the name of God? And what did Yitzhak Avinu do? Obedient. He didn't second guess. He didn't question. If I was Yitzhak Avinu, I would have told my father, I don't doubt that God told you to sacrifice your son, but maybe he means Yishmael. Maybe it's the other son. He's deserving to be sacrificed. But maybe you got the wrong guy. And still what? Yitzhak Avinu obediently goes and respects his father, Kibud Av. Yaakov Avinu also respected his parents. As we read, when Rivka, his mother, tells Yaakov, go in and steal the blessings. Yaakov was risking his life to deceive his father, to dress up like Esav. But what? His mother told him to do it. And then when his mother told him, run away from Esav, what does the Pasuk say by it? Say Yaakov. Yaakov right away obediently listens. So says of Chaim Palachi, you know why our fathers are called Avot? Because in their Zechut was that they respected their fathers. And since they respected and they excelled in Kibud Av and Kibud Em, so they are called Avot. And they were blessed with children that respect them. Because that's the reward for children that respect their parents. They have children that respect them. And therefore we call them Avot. They deserve that title because they epitomize respecting their parents. And therefore we're today respecting them. Midah keneged midah. Our rabbis tell us that during this exile that we are in now, which has been, incidentally, the longest exile in our history, close to 2,000 years, we have been living in exile as a result of the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. The first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed for 70 years. That's a very small exile. This exile dates back when the Roman Empire, under the dictatorship and tyranny of Titus, that destroyed our second temple. We are still in exile from that day. And the Hakamim ask, this exile is called Galut Edom, the exile of Edom, the exile of Esav. And the rabbis ask, Why is Esav's exile, the one that he activated, why is it the longest? And our rabbis tell us because Esav had a zechut. And he's living off that zechut. And you know what that zechut was that he had? Esav was good at one thing. He respected his father. To the extent the Gemara says, Rabban Gamliel once said himself, all my life I respected my father, but I didn't reach a hundredth of the respect that Esav did to Yitzhak. In that zechut, Esav has had rulership and success for over or close to 2,000 years. And our rabbis tell us, if Mashiach is going to come, if the Savior is going to come to redeem us, it must be that we have to neutralize the zechut of Esav. And how do Jews neutralize the zechut? We have to respect our parents. When we respect our parents and fulfill the mitzvah kibud av va'em, that negates the zechut of Esav. But until we can respect our parents like we're supposed to, whether they're alive or deceased, it makes no difference. Respect of parents is as long as there's children that are alive, not as long as the parents are alive. Because children can respect their parents in many ways, even long after their death. And therefore, if we want to weaken the zechut of Esav, we must also have that zechut. And our rabbis tell us that there's going to be two Mashiachim. There's going to be two phases of the Messianic era. There's going to be Mashiach ben Yosef, and then there's going to be Mashiach ben David. The first Mashiach comes from the tribe of Yosef, and then the ultimate Mashiach is ben David, comes from the tribe of Yehuda, from David HaMelech. And a rabbi saying, what zechut did Yosef have, or does Yosef have, that from him is going to come one of the Mashiachim? And you know what the answer is? Because of this story right here. Esav respected his father like nobody did. To the extent he even was willing to sacrifice his life for the respect of his father. Yitzhak liked food from the hunting. So Esav risked his life every day to go out to the field and hunt, even though he was putting his life in danger. But what? My father likes the animals to eat. He says it himself, Hineh anuchi holech lamut. Esav says, behold, I'm going to die, I'm a hunter. Why did Esav subject himself to such a risky profession? Because his father liked it. So what zechut negates that? When Yaakov Avinu tells his son Yosef, go out to the field and see how your brothers are doing. The same field that Esav went out to respect his father, now Yosef goes out to that field to respect his father. But what's the common denominator? They both fulfilled kibud av, risking their lives. And therefore Yosef neutralizes the zechut of Esav. And that's why he's zochet to have the Redeemer, Mashiach ben Yosef, come from him. Hence this is a very significant pasuk. But the question is, why did God engineer it this way? Where Yosef should go down to his brothers through a fatherly commandment. Because why did it have to happen this way? We have a principle. Shiluchem mitzvah enam nizukim. Somebody that's sent on a mission, specifically a mitzvah mission, it's an insurance. You can't get damaged. You can't get hurt. Those that are going on a mission for mitzvot, there's a protection. There's a certain amount of safety that a person enjoys when he's going on a mission to do a mitzvah. And therefore Yaakov knew, or God I should say knew, God knew, that Yosef now was going on a very risky mission. Not with his brothers. That was considered easy compared to where he was about to go. He was about to go down to Egypt. Imagine, ladies, one Jew in the entire land of Egypt. How difficult was it for Yosef to maintain his Judaism? There was no minyan. Forget about minyan. There was no zimun. There was no three people of Jews. There was no two Jews. The only Jew living in a corrupt society filled with immorality and idolatry and decadence and degeneracy. Yosef now was in the most dangerous of positions. A young boy of 17 years old. We're worried when our children go off to a college for a few years. We're nervous that they should not become influenced. We're nervous if our children have to go to Las Vegas for a trade show for 2 days. We're concerned on the influence. And that's where there's a minyan of Jews, and there's kosher food, and there's probably even a daf yomi. And still we're scared. Could you imagine how petrifying it was, for Yosef, a 17-year-old handsome boy, to be in a land of filth, all alone. And then he was seduced. He worked for a fellow called Potiphar, as you know, and the wife of Potiphar tried to make Yosef commit a sin of immorality. And she worked on him, it says, day after day for 12 months, trying to get Yosef to fall, to commit the sin. And then there was the moment of truth. And at the moment of truth, it says Yosef remembered. He saw the image of his father. And when he saw the image of his father in his mind, he said, "How could I commit such a sin?" And what is this image? What is this image of his father? Demut diyuk noshin aviv. What is this image that we're talking about? Rav Chaim Palachi explains as follows. He says, that's why God made Yaakov send him. He went on a mission of kibud av. And therefore, shiluchei mitzvah enam nizukim. He was saved from the sin because he was involved in the mitzvah. He never came back to his father to report. So all those years in Egypt, he was still in the middle of the mitzvah. He never went back to tell his father the report that his father asked for. And therefore he was not only physically saved, but spiritually the mitzvah of Kibud Av protected and insulated Yosef from committing the sin with his father. And that's what it means, Za'ad Demut Diyuk Noshel Aviv. He saw the image of his father, meaning the mitzvah of Kibud Av, the mitzvah of obedience, that he listened, that already served him well and protected him from committing any chas v'shalom promiscuity with the wife of Potiphar. And this is why God made it happen as such. Hachamim go on to tell us that the brothers made a decision to throw Yosef into a pit. The Torah tells us that while the brothers thought that the pit was empty, they thought it was a hollow pit. However, the Hakamim tell us in Gemara that while there wasn't any water in the pit, but Nechashim ve'akrabim yeshbo, there were snakes and scorpions in the pit. So it was actually a very dangerous situation. So the question our rabbis have, how come they didn't see the snakes and scorpions? Well, obviously they must have looked in the pit before they threw him. How come they weren't aware of the Nahashim and the Akrabim? How come they weren't aware they were trying to save him? When he was thrown in the pit, this was the advice of Reuven. Reuven's idea was, throw him into the pit. Then he figured the brothers will leave, he'll come back, and he'll save his brother. Why would Reuven should have analyzed to see if there was Nachashim Bakrabim. The halakha tells us, God forbid, if a man falls into a pit of snakes and scorpions, you could assume that he's dead. His wife is allowed to remarry. The assumption is that he's not going to make it. That's how dangerous it is. So how come Reuven, who was trying to save his brother, how come he didn't see the snakes and scorpions? So there's an interesting explanation by the Gaon Rabbi Eliyahu from Vilna. He explains it based on a passage in the Talmud in Gemara Shabbat. The Gemara has a statement in the name of a rabbi called Rav Tanhum. Listen to what Rav Tanhum taught. We're coming to the holiday of Hanukkah. He said the following: Ner Hanukkah, if you have the light of Hanukkah, the menorah, that you place it very high, 20 cubits high, pesula, it's no good. What's the reason why it's no good? Because the purpose of the menorah is so people can see the light, to publicize the miracle. When you put it so high, people don't walk in the street with their heads in the sky. Therefore you have to put it in a place low enough that the person's eyes can catch the light, can see the light. That was Rav Tanhum's chidush. You can't place the menorah more than 20 cubits high. Good, Azaka Baruch, good chidush. Then Rav Tanhum taught another chidush in the Gemara. He said, the pit that they threw Yosef in did not have water, but it had snakes and scorpions in it. Good, nice chidush as well. So the Gaon, the Bidiyal from Vilna says, what's the connection between these two statements? You know, when the rabbis make statements in Gemara, there's usually a connection between one statement and the next. In one breath you're talking about the laws of Hanukkah. In the next breath you're talking about the pit that Yosef was thrown into. Rabbi, what's the connection between, what's the association between both of your statements? Why did you say them back to back to each other? And the Gaon explained, because the same reason why the Ner Hanukkah is not good when it's high, 20 cubits, is because you can't see it. That's the same reason why the brothers, when they threw him in the pit, did not see the snakes and scorpions. Because he says, you know how deep the pit was? It was also 20 cubits deep. So therefore when they looked down, they weren't able to see with their eyes the bottom of the pit. And therefore Rav Tanhum was actually answering our question. The reason that the brothers did not see the snakes and scorpions is the same reason why Ner Hanukkah above 20 cubits is pesula. Because the eyes don't look so high. And for the same reason the eyes cannot penetrate and look so low. And therefore they weren't able to see it. Our Hakamim tell us that Yehuda, the Torah says it, Yehuda tells the brothers, you know what? Instead of killing Yosef, let's sell him. What do we gain by killing him? Let's sell him. It was his idea to sell him to the Arabs. So they agreed to Yehuda, and they find a caravan passing by, and they make a sale. They sold Yosef, and the Targum explains, they sold him for 20 coins. And then the Targum says, what did they do with the 20 coins? It says they bought for themselves a pair of shoes. And this is quite interesting. As a matter of fact, the beginning of our Haftarah this week points this out. When the Haftarah tells us, Al Mikhram Bakesef Sadiq Ve'evyon Ba'avur Na'alayim, the Navi clearly tells us in Amos that the sin of the brothers was they sold Yosef for a pair of shoes. And our rabbis are bothered. Well, now's the time to go shopping for a pair of shoes? You just sold your brother. I mean, there's a time for everything. All of a sudden, that was on their mind now. How are they going to spend the 20 coins? Give the 20 coins to charity. They needed the 20 coins. The brothers were wealthy independently. What does the Navi have to go out of their way and tell us? No, they wanted to buy a pair of shoes. What's with the shoes? So the explanation is like this. And this is a very important lesson that you have to keep in mind as you read this entire parasha. The brothers, before they judged Yosef, they held a bet din. Bet din means they sat in court, a court of Jewish law, like the Hachamim do, and they analyzed the evidence, and they analyzed the proofs, and they held that Yosef was guilty, not according to their opinion. They held he was guilty according to Torah law. They felt he was pursuing them. They felt that he was trying to become the king over them. And they felt that for different reasons that they had evidence that he deserved to be punished. We have a rule. If somebody is judged by the high court, for example, let's say the Sanhedrin, the great court of the land, judges somebody guilty of a death penalty, and then he's executed because he committed a capital crime. The halakha says from the Gemara, in such a case the family does not mourn the victim. Because since he died capital punishment according to the law, he is not mourned. His death is a kapara, but he is not subject to the laws of Avelut. And therefore in this case, the brothers, they wanted to show that the judging of Yosef was not done out of personal vengeance, or not done out of animosity. They held that he was guilty according to the Torah law. So what did they do right after? Instead of taking off their shoes as a sign of mourning, because that's what a person does when he's in mourning, the first thing he does is he takes off his shoes. They wanted to show that this is halachic law, this is binding by the Torah. And therefore, to make the point, what did they do? They went out and bought a new pair of shoes to say that we don't have to mourn him. What we did was right. What we did was correct. This is considered a Beit Din's ruling. And therefore, to make it clear, they bought na'alayim. They bought their shoes. And the Torah tells us that the caravan that Yosef ended up riding down to Egypt, the Arabs that were bringing him down, the caravan was filled with spices, with besamim, with fragrant spices, good smelling, aromatic, fragrant items, perfumes. And the Hachamim are concerned because that's not the normal load that Arabs usually travel with. Arabs usually travel, the Hachamim tell us, with neft, which would be like oil, and tar, and things that smell. It seems things never change, even in the olden days. The Arabs were involved with the oil. So the Hachamim are shocked. Isn't it odd? Isn't it strange that Yosef should find a caravan of Arabs that are transporting Bisamim? Normally, they should be riding an oil truck. And here Yosef was able to at least go down and smell something that was pleasant to him. And the Hachamim point out from here that when God levies a punishment on a person, when God is giving judgment on somebody, it is done with meticulous precision. Which means Yosef was judged to go down to Egypt. But what? On the way down, it was not judged that he should have to smell something that doesn't smell good. So therefore God gave him at least a pleasant trip on the way down, that he shouldn't have to smell something that's not proper for him to smell. That shows us that when God forbid there's judgment on a person, everything that's happening, bar minan, you have to know is coming from God. There's nothing that's happening by chance. There's nothing that you could say more happened than should have happened. No. If a person deserves two shots from the doctor, he's not going to get three shots. And if he deserves three, he's not going to get four. And if he doesn't deserve any, he won't get any. Which means everything is exactly measured according to what the person deserves. And that should be a little comforting. Because sometimes when there's judgment in the world, we sometimes think that it's not happening by God, Chas v'Shalom. We think that it's just happening by nature, by haphazard, that there's no control, that things are just happening by themselves. But you have to know that God is micromanaging every second and every step and every moment. To the T. God decided that Yosef should have to go down to Egypt. He's going to have to suffer in prison for 10 years. But what? It wasn't destined that he has to smell oil on the way down. So God manages it that the caravan that he's riding has besamim. That shows you everything, even the smallest detail. If it's not destined from God, it will not happen. So nobody should think that once a person is going through what they call bad luck, there's no such thing as bad luck. Everything is from Borei Olam. But what appears to be as a bad string of happenings, you say nothing is going right, as if you lost the divine protection. You have to say no. Borei Olam, everything that a person is the occurrences that are happening to him, they are all measured and judged and analyzed beforehand. There is no such thing as getting more than you deserve or less than you deserve. As a matter of fact, when they took Yosef out of the prison after 10 years, then they added an additional 2 years. So he was in prison for a subtotal of 12 years. On that day, how did he leave the prison? It says he left the prison, he saw two members that were with him in prison. They woke up one morning and their faces were long. They were depressed. So Yosef goes up to them and says, "Madua penechem ra'im hayom? Why are you so upset? Why do you look so despondent? What's the matter? You don't look happy." The answer could be very simple. They're in prison. Did you see anybody that's happy in prison? I mean, what kind of question is Yosef asking the prisoners? And what do you look so sad? What do I look so sad? What do you think the prisons looked like in Egypt 3,500 years ago? There were no hotels. They were not a spa. They weren't a country club. Today, the prisons are rat holes. Could you imagine what they were 3,500 years ago in Egypt? So Yosef asks them very innocently, "Well, what are you all upset? You look like you're in a bad mood today." "What do you mean, bad mood? Look where we are. We're in Gehinnom on earth. We're living over here underground in a pit." So the rabbis point out that Yosef had a lot of faith. Yosef was the ultimate optimist. Yosef had tremendous belief in God. And Yosef's faith and belief and attitude was contagious. And therefore all the people that were with him in the prison cell had a good spirit. They were normally in good spirits. Why? Because Yosef's nature was of that, to preach belief and faith and trust, and everything is from God, and everything has a purpose, and everything has a reason, and better days will come. And therefore it was a shock that if somebody in Yosef's prison cell looked a little down, Yosef said, "Oh, what's going on with you? That's not normally the emotions that are happen in this prison cell." To show you the greatness of Yosef HaSadiq, his faith affected others. So what did they tell him? "We had a dream last night, and our dreams are very concerning. The butler and the baker." Now, do you know what day of the year these dreams took place? Well, Hakamim tell us that Yosef was eventually released out of the prison when Paro had his dreams. Paro had his dreams on Rosh Hashanah. And it says that's one of the things that happened on Rosh Hashanah. Yosef was released from the dungeon. But that was 2 years later. 2 years before on Rosh Hashanah, to the day, the butler and the baker had their dreams. And therefore, they tell Yosef, we dreamt, we saw that the grapes, and I was squeezing the grapes into the cup of Paro, and I gave the cup to Paro. Yosef said, your dream means you're going to be reinstated. You're going to get your job back. The baker said, I dreamt that there were baskets on my head. There was baked goods in the baskets. The birds came and ate the goods. Yosef said, your dream symbolizes that in 3 days from now, you are going to be executed. And sure enough, 3 days later, the butler got his job back, and the baker was executed. But before the butler got his job back, Yosef tells him, Ki im zechartani, uschartani, on the condition, v'ischartani, on the condition that you remember me, and that you remind Paro that I am in prison. Which means Yosef felt that this was a good opportunity. He just gave him his life. Now he's going to go back. He's going to rub elbows with the king. Go remind the king that I'm in here. Go tell the king that there's a good man, Yosef, in prison. He's nice. He's smart. Maybe you could do some bidding for me. Maybe you're the agent that God sent for me to get out of jail. And our rabbis tell us that because Yosef put his reliance on the butler, by saying two words, Uskartani ve'izkartani, God punished them for 2 more years in prison. 2 words, 2 more years. Why? We would say, he's making his effort. Aren't you? Of course we all trust in God. Of course we all rely on God. Of course we all have bitachon. But isn't there a concept of hishtadlut? Isn't there a concept where you have to make your effort? Don't you have to try? And the explanation is yes, you do. But on Yosef's level, Yosef was so great, and his bitachon was so perfect, for him, even saying 2 words was considered a lack of faith. For people that have normal faith, or less than normal faith, you have to make an effort. But the more faith you have, the less effort you have to make. And therefore for Yosef's level of bitachon, even asking the Sara Mashkin to help him a little, that was considered, you were putting your reliance on man. And therefore God punished him severely. There was once a rabbi walking down the street. He saw a coin. A lost object. He said, beautiful, there's a lost coin. Halakha says you can keep it. So he bent down to pick it up. And then he said, wait, I have faith in God. If God wanted me to get this coin, I wouldn't even have to bend. The coin would come to me without even having to exert effort. So he left. He went to the synagogue. He gets to the synagogue. A wealthy man comes to him and says, Rabbi, today's your lucky day. He says, why? He says, I was walking down the street and I found a coin. He says, I have no use for it, so I figured I'll give it to you. So the rabbi told him, so you see that? If it's coming to you, you don't even have to make an effort. But that's only for great men. That's only for great men that have such faith, that believe. Like Eliyahu HaNavi. When Eliyahu HaNavi was in the field, when he was running away from the king Ahav, he was in the field without food. What happened? He relied on Borei Olam. He says, the same God that fed me in the city can feed me in the field. And what did God do? He sent them ravens. Every morning the ravens came with food on a tray and delivered it to Eliyahu HaNavi, like room service. Every day Eliyahu HaNavi. And where did the ravens get the food from? Not from the garbages. Says the ravens would fly into the king's kitchen. So he was eating royal food every day delivered to him on time by Orvin, by the ravens. To teach you what? that when it comes to having faith in Borei Olam, there are no such thing as something difficult for Borei Olam. Borei Olam is able to provide and is able to sustain under all conditions. Our problem is, we don't believe it. When we think there's no solution, we think nobody has a solution. God has solutions to every problem. When we think it's unsolvable to you. But the Borei Olam, there's thousands of options. There's no such thing as something that is unsolvable or a wall that's impossible to break. And the Yahweh Nabi's in the field, where's he going to get food? Borei Olam will handle it. Sure enough, the food arrives from the most special place. And that's the same thing with Yosef. Because he was on such a high level, it's a compliment. Because he was on such a high level, he should not have petitioned the Sara Mashkim even to remember him. Even those two words were considered too much effort on Yosef's part. I know we're going over, and I'll just conclude with one idea. This is for all the times that I ended early, if I ever ended early. Be'ezat Hashem, Sunday night, we're going to begin the holiday of Hanukkah. On Hanukkah, it is our law that we read the Sefer Torah every day of the 8 days. We take out Sefer. And we read Parashat Naso. Parashat Naso, we read about the different sacrifices that the presidents of the tribes brought during the inauguration of the Mishkan. When the tabernacle was inaugurated in the desert many years ago, every day of the first 12 days of the inauguration ceremonies, every day another tribe came and brought their sacrifice. Why do we read the inauguration of the Mishkan on Hanukkah? What's the connection? And the connection is because the Mishkan was actually finished being built on the 25th day of Kislev, the exact day where we celebrate Hanukkah. That was the day the Jewish people finally got all the furnishings ready and all the curtains ready, and they were ready to open up the Mishkan for business. And God said, no, we're not ready yet. Go put the Mishkan in storage and I'll tell you when we're going to inaugurate it. And a few months later, on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, God told Moshe, today's the day. So the Midrash says that the month of Kislev came to God and said, it's not fair. I was supposed to have a holiday, the 25th of Kislev. That's when the Mishkan was finished. And now I got bumped. You bumped my holiday to Nisan. You owe me one. So God told the month of Kislev, so to speak, don't worry, your day will come. And sure enough, in the times of the second Beit HaMikdash, when the Greeks defiled our temple, on which day did we re-inaugurate the Beit HaMikdash? Did we re-purify the Beit HaMikdash and re-sanctify it? On the 25th day of Kislev. So the Hanukkah is the payback to the month of Kislev. And therefore we read the Korbanot of those presidents that should have been brought on the 25th of Kislev. So therefore there's a connection between the rededication of the temple to the dedication of the Mishkan. But there's something fascinating about that parasha. It's over 70 pesukim. And if you look at it inside, most of the pesukim are repetitious. Because all the 12 tribes brought the exact same korban every single day. And the Torah repeats it 12 times. On day 1, he brought the korban, this is what it was. Day 2, he brought the korban, this is what... 12 times repeating the same exact story. Our Torah is very, very economical when it comes to its words. It doesn't waste a letter. And here the Torah writes the same thing 12 times. It could have written it once and said, and the other 11 did the same thing. Why does it have to be so verbose and so lengthy in repeating it 12 times? So the Hafetz Chaim said a beautiful explanation. He said, each tribe, when it was their day, they had an idea. Each one is going to bring a unique korban. Each one is going to represent their tribe by bringing a special sacrifice. Each one wanted to formulate a special, distinct Qurban. But what happened? Came one of the tribes, the second tribe, from the tribe of Yisachar, a man called Netanel ben Suhar. And Netanel ben Suhar told the other leaders, listen, if every day we're going to start bringing our own Qurbanot, you know what's going to happen? It's going to lead to jealousy. It's going to lead to competitiveness. Because on the second day, the second Nasi is going to say, oh, you brought 5 Qurbanot yesterday? I'm bringing 6. And the next day, the third president's going to say, I see your 6, and I raise you 2, and I'll bring 8. And now all of a sudden it's going to lead to divisiveness, and it's going to lead to arguments, and it's going to lead to hatred. So you know what Netanel ben Suhar told the other tribes? Let's make a deal. We'll all bring the same Qurban. In order to keep unity, we'll put our tribal ambitions on the side in order for the sake of peace that everybody will bring the same sacrifice. You know what God said? You sought to make peace amongst the Jewish nation? I am going to write it 12 times. You all deserve to get the same amount of pesukim. Instead of saying, yeah, and they all copied the first one. The Torah goes out of its way to show that when Am Yisrael wants to make a effort to be united, so Borei Olam respects it, and Borei Olam pays tribute and honor to those that want to be united. And as a matter of fact, on Shabbat, one of the 12 days of the inauguration was Shabbat. The tribe that brought on Shabbat was Ephraim. We have a law that says you can only bring public sacrifices on Shabbat. A private sacrifice you cannot bring on Shabbat. This Qurban of the tribes was a private sacrifice. How was Ephraim allowed to bring his Qurban on Shabbat? And you know what the Midrash says? Borei Olam says, this Qurban symbolizes unity. It symbolizes oneness. Bring it on Shabbat. Even though you're not normally allowed to, this overrides the Shabbat. Bring the Qurban. And that's the lesson of Hanukkah, where we get together with our families. It's a time where we put aside all ill will. We put aside all our friction that we might have with family members. Where we stand together at the menorah, and we make the berachot, and we light. It's a time of unity. It's a time of closeness. It's a time that our families come together to rededicate themselves to the Torah and the mitzvot. And not holding grudges and bearing animosity. We must learn from the Qurbanot that we read every day. It's the same Qurban every day. It's equality. None of the tribes wanted to show, I'm better, I have more, you only brought 5, I brought 7, God likes me more. The lesson of Hanukkah is equality. It's the same. There's no strife and there's no jealousy. And that's an important lesson that we must teach our children as well during the holiday of Hanukkah. Not only to read the Sefer, but to learn the message of the Sefer Torah. Hanukkah, the holiday of lights, the holiday of Ahdut.